Thank you, Dan, for that promotion. Apparently, I'm an evangelist now. Wow. I didn't know I was an evangelist, but moving up in the world. All right. So, anyway, it's great to be here. I've known Dan for many years. He is the apologetics wonk around here. We've got an apologetics certificate program. And if you listen to the classes, Dan's there all the time. And whenever I'm not sure, I stop and say, Dan, is that right? All right, because Dan knows more about Christian apologetics than I do. I don't know, been a professor or whatever, so they have me speak instead of Dan. But Dan could do this talk, I guarantee you. Anyway, so we're going to do three parts here. First part, we're going to talk about God and science, a little bit about why I believe as a scientist, it's only reasonable to believe in God. Then I'll do just a little bit about science and the Bible, and then we'll take a break. And then I'm going to talk about the Bible and the question of the age of the earth and talk a little bit about evolution, because everybody knows that evolution is Satan's plan to destroy the minds of people and send them to hell, right? Yeah. Oh, no, that's not true. Okay, great. So the first two talks will be a little bit more apologetics, as in, you know, kind of to share with those who are not believers. And the second talk will be a little bit more like to help us out to how to deal with the kinds of questions that that are raised by science. All right, so I'm going to start. I'll talk a little bit about God and science, and I'm going to talk about two possible perspectives about explaining the world around us. One would be the atheist perspective, that would be represented by, for example, Thomas Huxley. Thomas Huxley was a good friend of Charles Darwin. In fact, he was known as Darwin's bulldog. He said, we are as much the product of blind forces as is the falling of a stone to earth, the ebb and flow of the tides. It just happened, and man was made flesh by a series of singularly beneficial accidents. In other words, it's just an accident. There's no purpose, no design in nature, and that's the best explanation. Now, I would say if that were true, then that would be some really, really lucky accidents. Quite a lucky accident to make you, never mind the shirt that you're wearing, okay? Another representative of this idea would be our good friend Richard Dawkins, who wrote The God Delusion. All right, and he said, in the universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, others are going to get lucky. You won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe, we observe, has precisely the properties one would expect if there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. It just is, and we dance to its music. If that's true, it sure is depressing. So he's saying there is no design, no purpose. So you know what your purpose is? You have none. You know why you're here? Just complete, utter accident. That's the atheist perspective. And, you know, I work around people that take this perspective, being a scientist, you can imagine. All right, and I'm going to talk about another perspective, which is the idea of design. William Paley, could I borrow somebody's cell phone, please? Good, hers was not turned on, so that's good. All right, so let's instead of the watchmaker argument, I like the cell phone argument. I'm going to give it back to you eventually, okay? All right, so let's imagine you're walking down the road. You see that thing sitting there on the ground. And you're thinking, how did that get there? Well, I don't know, maybe there was some glass and some metal and some cars ran over it and people kicked it and boom, cell phone. What do you think about that? That's insane. I mean, the fact that it's designed is so obvious that if anybody thinks this happened by random accident, they'd be crazy. Which has more complexity? Which has more design? Which has more moving parts? A cell phone or a bacteria? The answer is a bacteria, I believe, has far more moving parts. A bacteria is a nanofactory of unimaginable complexity. And yet, some people say, it just happened. Blind, pitiless indifference, a singular series of very beneficial accidents. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to spend some time covering things that I would cover just in my introductory chemistry or physics classes that I teach, and talking about why I believe the idea of God is obvious from the point of view of science. Let me give you a little bit of my background. So I grew up going to church. It was a liberal Protestant denomination. I was the guy who was carrying the cross around and wearing those funny robes. And I was the president of the church youth group. But the problem is, I didn't believe in God. I was an atheist. And apparently it didn't matter in that church, which that's interesting. So anyway, I went off to college, and I was quite convinced of my atheism. And I remember being in the dorm, and these Christian guys would come around sharing their faith. We'd laugh. What a bunch of idiots. And I remember taking philosophy as a freshman, and we're studying Nietzsche. You know, Friedrich Nietzsche? And Nietzsche famously said, God is dead. I was like, yeah, that's pretty cool. But you know what? Because of studying science, because of studying physics and chemistry, I came to realize that there is a God. So I'm going to talk a little bit about why I believe science points very strongly in that direction. So here we go. I'm going to talk about water. Now, you could teach an entire one semester course just to explain and describe the properties that are unique to water. But every single one of those properties, if water didn't have that property, there'd be no life. And the question is, are we going to argue for accident, or are we going to argue for design? All right, so there's a few things about water. First of all, water is bent at about 105 degree angle. Is that about right, Mr. Science Professor over here? Got it right? Yeah. It turns out if water was not bent, then it wouldn't be polar. And if water wasn't polar, then it would boil at about minus 150 degrees centigrade, and we would all instantly vaporize, which wouldn't work too well. See, life requires a liquid. You cannot base a living thing on a gas. That makes no sense. On a solid, absolutely not. And that liquid, that compound has to be a liquid somewhere between around minus 20 centigrade and about 80 centigrade. Below that temperature range, there's not enough energy for chemical reactions to happen. Above that temperature, sensitive molecules simply fall apart. And water happens to be liquid across almost that entire range, but not the whole range, luckily for us. So one of the properties of water is it just happens to be liquid in the right temperature range. Another property of water is its solvent properties. Now, scientists would tell you, in order for this liquid to support life, it has to be able to dissolve a wide variety of molecules. Well, guess what liquid dissolves a wider variety of molecules than any other? Water, of course, the one that has the right boiling point. In fact, that solvent would have to dissolve ions. We were talking about ions. Where's Macon? Yeah, he was asking me, what's an ion? I said, Macon, you don't know what an ion is? He didn't have chemistry in high school, all right? But most of us know what an ion is. It turns out, unless this liquid dissolves ions, there could be no life. And guess how many compounds that are liquid in that temperature range dissolve ions? Only one. Only water. So the compound that has the right boiling point just so happens to be the only compound that dissolves ions. Water dissolves a very wide range of molecules, but not all molecules. Lucky for us, otherwise we'd all be a puddle. Another property that water has is it has, excuse the fancy term, a high specific heat. What that means, it absorbs a lot of heat. Water absorbs 10 times more heat than almost all other substances, and more than twice as much heat as any other substance, luckily for us. Now, would you rather live near the coast or in the Inland Empire? That's an easy question, right? Why is that? Because water absorbs so much heat. In fact, if water had the specific heat of all other compounds, then the temperature of the Earth would go up and down by 200 or 300 degrees centigrade in any given year. No life. Water has a couple other properties that are worth mentioning. By the way, we were talking about Wisconsin earlier, and I lived in Wisconsin for 7 years. And Wisconsin, the people there have this amazing ability, they can walk on water. In the winter. All right. Now, it turns out, every compound, every single compound, the solid sinks and the liquid floats. Guess how many exceptions there are? Only one. It just so happens to be water. Well, why is that important? Because in the winter, the colder ice floats on top of the warmer water. Otherwise, the lakes would freeze to the bottom. Okay. But during ice ages, oceans would freeze to the bottom. And again, any kind of complex life would disappear. Now, water has another really weird property. Every other compound in the world, if you plot density versus temperature, it goes like this. Guess how many exceptions there are? Only one. It's water. Because water does this, then below 4 degrees centigrade, it goes like that, and then it does that. All right? Why is that important? Because what that means is in the winter, the colder ice floats on top of the colder water, which floats on top of the warmer water. And by the way, water is a good conductor of heat, and ice is a very bad conductor of heat. It's a wonderful system. All right? We could talk about the viscosity of water. We could talk about many other properties of water, but we'll move on. Now, but before I do, here's the question. Accident or design? What is common sense leading you toward if you simply know how to use common sense? All right. Now, some of you probably are going to have, you know, hives or you're breaking out in sweat right now. All right, great. Now, I tell my students that a guy named Mendeleev invented this chart. A couple of years ago, I actually lectured in Mendeleev's lecture hall there in Kiev. But anyway, it's not true. I believe God designed this chart. Now, here's a question for the atheist. Why are there so many elements? In fact, why are there elements at all? And why do those elements have the properties they have? Now, I'll tell you the answer. It's because God designed them so we could be here. I'm just telling you. And God's fingerprints are all over this chart. There are at least 20 elements that I know of that have a property that no other element has. In every case, if that element didn't have that property, we wouldn't be here. All right, so which element am I going to start with? You're supposed to say carbon. Carbon. I could have started with hydrogen. We'll start with hydrogen since he suggested that. Okay, hydrogen has this property of being able to produce massive energy through fusion. And it's the only element that produces massive energy through fusion. Lucky for us, otherwise we wouldn't have stars and we wouldn't have life. I was going to talk about carbon. Hydrogen was a good choice, but now that I said carbon, you have to agree, carbon's the most obvious one. Okay, great. I teach organic chemistry. I spend the first week when I teach organic chemistry, and we're going to be tutoring Josh in organic chemistry this fall. Yes, all right. Anyway, I spend the first week talking about all the properties that are unique to carbon that no other element has. And every single one of those properties, if carbon didn't have that property, there'd be no life. And the thing is, the same element has to have all those properties. If one element had this property and another element had the other one, it just wouldn't work. The whole system wouldn't work. All right, one of the properties of carbon is that it forms four bonds. It's actually not the only element that forms four bonds. Silicon does as well. But the problem with silicon is that if you put two silicon atoms together in a molecule, that molecule explodes, which wouldn't really work very well. So why is it important to have four bonds? The reason it's important to have four bonds is unless you have four bonds, the molecules are not three-dimensional. And if you don't have three-dimensional molecules, then you don't have three-dimensional living things. So that's pretty important. Now, it just so happens the only element that forms four bonds is also the only element that forms large molecules. And could you have large molecules? Could you have life without large molecules? Obviously not. Now, if it was the organic chemistry course that I talk about, the fact that carbon forms single, double, and triple bonds and all that other rings and all that stuff, but I'm not going to go into that. All right, there are several other elements that have a property unique to that element without which there would be no life. The next one I want to talk about is iron. There it is. It's right Fe next to it. Yeah, oh, I can't even see it very well. All right, Iron. A chemistry professor having to find iron. That's kind of embarrassing. I know it's next to nickel, but it's on the other side of nickel. All right, great. There it is. All right. Now, the property that's unique to iron is it's the only element that forms a strong magnetic field. And you're thinking, why is it essential to have a strong magnetic field? Well, otherwise, what would you do with your kid's homework on the refrigerator? It's a joke. That's not what it is. Turns out, the sun is an absolutely amazing design. The whole thing with the sun is crazy amazing. All right, and the reason we need the sun, obviously, is to produce energy that catalyzes life. Now, it turns out 90% of the energy coming from the sun is visible light, lucky for us, because that's the only kind of light that can catalyze chemical reactions without destroying molecules. But there are two kinds of energy that come from the sun, both of which would destroy all advanced life forms. Luckily, God invented two different elements to take care of those. One of them is iron, because it turns out the sun produces very high energy ionized particles, solar wind, if you will. And that would destroy all life on the earth, unless it was deep underneath the ground. But luckily, the earth has a magnetic field. And the magnetic field of the earth acts literally like a force field to deflect those particles around the earth. All right, now here's the interesting thing about iron. Because it just so happens, not only is iron the only magnetic element, it's also the most stable element. In other words, iron has the most stable nucleus. And guess what the earth is made out of mostly? Iron. Why is it made out of mostly iron? Because it's the most stable nucleus. So if the only magnetic element wasn't also the most stable element, again, no life on the earth. I'm thinking this is evidence for design. What do you think? You know, I interact with atheists fairly often in a scientific setting, and I sometimes shake my head. How do they maintain that faith? I know there's aspects of faith problems for us as Christians, but how atheists can maintain faith in this idea in light of the evidence, it's crazy. I don't know how they do it. That was sarcasm, by the way. All right, good. What about oxygen? It's funny because oxygen comes in two forms, and both forms are absolutely essential to advanced life forms. One is O2, and it's the only molecule that allows us to support high metabolism life forms. The other form is O3, which is very, very poisonous, but lucky for us, almost all the ozone is in the upper atmosphere, where it absorbs the short wavelength ultraviolet, protecting us from that kind of energy as well. Other few others. I'll just do one more. Let's talk about uranium. Now, you probably think uranium is dangerous, right? It's because it is. Because it's radioactive. Actually, believe it or not, uranium is not that radioactive. It's really not, because it has a very long half-life of around 4.5 billion years. Lucky for us. Because if uranium was not radioactive, and if it did not have a half-life of 4-point-something billion years, because what happens is the uranium is producing heat inside the Earth. Otherwise, the Earth would have been cold all the way to the middle, in which case we wouldn't have plate tectonics. And plate tectonics is this massive recycling system, so the minerals of the earth are constantly recycled, otherwise the surface would be sterile. And also, without plate tectonics, we'd have no atmosphere. So thank you, God, for uranium. And thank you that it has such a long half-life. By the way, another property of uranium is that it's really, really dense. So guess where almost all the uranium is? In the middle of the earth. Again, lucky for us. And if you don't want to live on a planet with uranium, just go to Mars. There's almost no uranium, and also almost no atmosphere, and a very sterile surface. All right, so that's a little chemistry. How about a little biochemistry? I also teach biochemistry. Who teaches physics and biochemistry? I teach physics, and I teach biochemistry. It's kind of a strange combination. Anyway, DNA. I mean, talk about design. This is crazy stuff. I'm sure everybody here has heard of DNA. You got your G's, your C's, your A's, and your T's. And these nucleotides, these four nucleotides, three of them, it forms a code for choosing the amino acid in order to build a protein. Let me ask a very simple question. Could a code be created by random collisions of molecules? No. It's ridiculous. Absurd. But there's people who believe that. Atheists. They believe that. Anyway, the amount of information we're talking about is startling. By the way, nature naturally creates order, like crystals and stuff, but nature never, ever creates information spontaneously. It never does. You're saying, what about evolution? We'll talk about it in a little bit. All right, and the amount of information is a lot. The human genome, about 3 billion base pairs, that's a lot of information. But that's not really a good model for the earliest life. The earliest life, let's say, maybe a bacteria. All right, maybe 100 million base pairs. Okay, 50 million base pairs. Okay, 25 million base pairs. So that's a lot of information. The probability of all the information required to form a living thing, even the simplest living thing, just by random interactions, would be like taking 25 million letters, throwing them in the air, and when they land, you could read them in Finnish, or whatever language. By the way, doing it a lot of times would not help. All right? This really just doesn't make any sense at all. And yet, remember, a singular series of beneficial accidents and all that kind of stuff. Blind, pitiless indifference. I say, actually, nonsense. That really doesn't make much sense at all. Now, here's the thing. In order for life to exist, the only thing in the universe that makes proteins is DNA. But the only thing in the universe that makes DNA is proteins. So you know about the chicken and the egg, right? How about DNA and proteins? How are we going to answer this? You know, they came up with this RNA world explanation. If you could ask a question about that later. But that does not work at all. So according to the atheists, what happened was, just by total random accident, let's say 25 million base pairs created all this DNA, and at the same time, and in the exact same place, the protein that would have made the DNA also came into existence, except that it didn't. And the DNA that would have made the protein also came, you see what I'm saying? Or even if you don't see what I'm saying, you get the idea that that's crazy, this doesn't make any sense. And anybody who believes in this, I don't know. I don't know what to say about that. All right, nature creates order, but not information. Okay, house of cards do not build themselves. And I'm telling you, that happening by random is infinitely more likely than what we just talked about. All right, even Charles Darwin said it's mere rubbish to think of the origin of life. That's Charles Darwin himself. All right, great. So let's talk about physics just a little bit. So you do a little chemistry, do a little biochemistry, do a little physics. All right. Before about the 1940s, physicists were quite unanimous about this, that the universe itself was eternal. All right. Now, why were they so sure about this? Why were they so confident? Was it because the evidence says the universe is eternal? The answer is no, that's not why. It's for philosophical reasons. Because either the universe is eternal or it's not eternal. And if the universe was not eternal, that means it was created, which means there's a creator, and atheists just didn't like that, so they really preferred the eternal universe situation. Of course, all along, the Bible had said, for example, in Hebrews 11, verse 3, by faith we know that things that are seen were not created from visible things, but from invisible things. Creation out of nothing is the biblical statement there. Genesis 1 agrees with this. Well, anyway, thanks to the work of Hubble and Penzias and Wilson and others, scientists kind of caught up with the Bible on this one. For example, in the 1930s, they discovered the universe is expanding, the redshift. But that was not enough. Physicists defended the idea of the eternal universe with another theory I won't get into. You could ask about it if you want. And then they discovered this background radiation, which is the sort of the leftover radiation from the event. And here's what physicists came around to. They came around to this idea that there was nothing. No time, no energy, no matter, nothing. Even time did not exist. And then in a single instant, in a flash of light, everything came from nothing. Ah, thank you very much. All right, caught up with the Christian explanation. And then as physicists began to investigate the nature of what appears to have happened, by the way, you can't prove the Big Bang happened. The science doesn't prove things. It only provides explanations which are consistent. But the data is consistent with it, so I tend to think it probably did. All right, when they started to do that, they noticed there's some astounding coincidences. All right, and so we talk about the finely tuned universe, because it turns out all these different parameters, I'll talk about a couple of them, have to simultaneously have a very, very exact value, or the thing doesn't work. And the fine-tuned universe, the fine-tuned orchestra is the idea. If all the instruments except two or three are tuned, all you hear is the one that's out of tune. For example, would you agree that that's a small number? That's a small number. 59 zeros and then a 1. Here's what they discovered. The force of gravity, which is the force which creates stars and galaxies and things like that, the force of gravity is tuned to the required value to a level of precision that is beyond our ability to understand how precise it is. Turns out, if the force of gravity had been weaker than it is, by that fraction, then planets and galaxies and stars would have never formed. On the other hand, if the force of gravity was greater than it is, by that proportion, then the universe would have collapsed almost as soon as it formed. So, two questions for the atheist. Number one, why is there gravity? That's a pretty basic question. Why is there gravity? Their answer? I don't know. It just is. Okay, fine. Now, why does gravity have the value exactly precise so that we could be here? I don't know. I want you to understand how unlikely that is. Does anybody here play like Super Lotto? Anybody here play Super Lotto? Good. You're Christians. You're not supposed to be gambling. All right, that's good. But let's say that you did, and you won the Super Lotto. What would your friends say to you after they questioned why you're playing the lottery? What would they say to you despite all that? Yeah, awesome. But then what if you won the Super Lottery the next week? Whoa. What if you won it again the third week? You'd be in jail, right? Slumdog Millionaire, right? Right? It turns out the probability, if you were to randomly choose a size for the force of gravity, the probability of hitting it right would be like winning the Super Lotto 6 times in a row. To me, that's like the probability that the atheist is right, that it's just an accident. That's a pretty low probability game to play. But don't try to read this slide. There's way too much information, and it keeps going and going and going. But it turns out this is a fact about almost every parameter that defines how the universe works. There are 4 fundamental forces. The gravity force, electric force, nuclear strong, and nuclear weak. All 4 of them are finely tuned. For example, the nuclear strong force, which is what holds the protons and neutrons together, about 3% larger, no hydrogen. Well, no hydrogen, no stars. About 3% weaker, and only hydrogen. That's also problematic for us. And all these parameters, nuclear weak force, amount of electrical charge, blah, 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 all of these have to simultaneously have these very precise values. In some cases, it's plus or minus 50%. In other cases, it's plus or minus 0.00000000001%. And I would say this begs the question, can a rational person believe that this is just an accident? I don't know. I know there's some people that I think are normally fairly rational who actually believe that. All right, great. Fine-tuning, Fred Hoyle, Anthony Flew. So I want to get to part two. We're going to have two quick parts here, and then we'll take a break. We'll do the other part. So, conclusion. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men and women are without excuse. That's what the Bible says. And I would say, let me add to that, I say the scientist has the least possible excuse for not believing in God. And they worship created things, the physical universe, rather than the Creator, and God gave them over to their desires. All right, great. Actually, that's not so great, but amen, you know? All right. Now, I want to share a story. A few years ago, I was in a van between venues at a conference for a bunch of science professors. And there's about six or eight of us sitting in the van. And this one lady said, Christianity, what a stupid religion. Can you believe anybody believes that nonsense? Notice this. She was assuming that those who were in the van would agree with her. Either that, or she was used to them keeping quiet about it, which, by the way, I don't do that, you know. So anyway, she said, did you know that in the Bible it says if people wear material with more than one clothing with more than one material, capital punishment? And I said, excuse me, but the Bible doesn't say that. She said, oh, yes, it does. I saw it at a website. Well, guess where she didn't see it? So anyway, so I said, you know, I've read the Bible at least, I don't know, maybe half a dozen times or so, and people say it's full of scientific errors. I said, you know, I've read it that many times, I haven't seen one yet. I don't even know what they're talking about. It got really quiet in that van. And then I pulled out my Bible. Yeah. And Macon has the 1978 NIV, the single column version. That's the one. Because I had to find the verse in Leviticus. Could you find that verse in Leviticus, the one that talks about clothing with more than one material? Because that's what I had to do. Uh-huh. Now, I knew it was in Leviticus on the right-hand side of the page about halfway down. Looked through it. I found it. Praise the Lord. And I read it. But see, this is typical. This is typical. Not unbelievers tend to assume that obviously anybody with intelligence and a lot of education would reject the idea of God, just like we rejected the tooth fairy and pixie dust and the cookie monster or whatever. But I say they're wrong about that. They're far wrong about that. Here's what Dallas McCown said. He said, Christianity is scientifically unsupported and probably insupportable. Hey, I'll give him credit. At least he said probably. All right. Philosophically suspect at best and disreputable at worst and historically fraudulent. Okay, that's easy to say. Nice rhetoric. All right, so Christianity is historically fraudulent. Okay, so can you tell me a single historical fact in the Bible that is inconsistent with what we know from archaeology and history? I don't know of a single one. I don't know what they're talking about. Philosophically suspect at best, that's another talk. We could talk about modernism, postmodernism, or any other ism compared to the Christian philosophy. And I'd say Christian philosophy wins hands down. But how about scientifically unsupported and probably insupportable? Again, to that I say, I don't know. I am a scientist. I've got a PhD in chemistry and physics. I don't know. I'm just looking for that scientific error. I just haven't found it yet. I'm sure it's there somewhere. So what I want to talk about is science and the Bible. Now, the Bible is clearly not a science book, right? Let me see. Do I have that quote from? No, I don't. Galileo said, the Bible is written to tell us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. Got it? That sounds better in English than it does in Italian, I guess. All right? And it's true. The Bible is not a science book. It's a God book. So we shouldn't read it as a scientific treatise. Why does it mention dinosaurs? Because what does dinosaurs have to do with going to heaven? I mean, it doesn't mention things like that. But I would say this. The Bible does not speak about science often, but when it does, The solid statements it makes that relate to science, I find to be always true and never inconsistent. So I want to talk about that just a little bit here. This is Papyrus Ebers. It's kind of the Egyptian equivalent of a PDR, Physician Desk Reference, published roughly around 1500 BC, which is relevant for us because that's roughly when Moses was involved in receiving Leviticus and Numbers in those books. And it's essentially a compendium of the medical knowledge in Egypt at that time. And scholars would tell us probably the most advanced medical knowledge in the ancient world was amongst the Chinese and the Egyptians. All right, so let's look at some of the prescriptions in Papyrus Ebers. All right, to prevent hair from turning gray, anoint it with the blood of a calf which had been boiled in the oil or with the fat of a rattlesnake. Okay? You've not been using that stuff. Okay. A mixture of six fats, namely those of the horse, the hippopotamus, crocodile, cat, snake, ibex, to prevent hair loss. And clearly I've not been using that, I suppose. Now, the purpose of these ingredients, these prescriptions, was to make the person more attractive to the opposite sex, I assume. Women, would you be hanging out with somebody wearing this stuff on their hair? I don't think so. Now, I'm making light of this. Look at some of the other medicines found in Papyrus Ebers. Lizard's blood, swine's teeth, rotten meat, moisture from pig's ear, excrement. Oh, yes, even human excrement being used as medicine. Now, we're chuckling at this, but this is not funny, not even one little bit. It is tragic. The average lifespan, probably less than 20 years. It's not that people couldn't live to be 80 or 100, they could, but almost everyone died from some kind of infectious disease. And these were the answers. All right, well, then there's the Bible, Exodus 15:26. God says, one of those verses you just read real quick and hardly notice. God says, if you obey the laws I'm giving you, then you will not experience any of the diseases of these other peoples. Think about it. What cultures have a continuous history of over 3,500 years? There's the Indian culture, the Chinese culture, the Egyptian culture, and the Jews. They don't seem to fit that list very well. Kind of kicked around and moved all over and people trying to wipe them out. I believe one of the reasons is when the Jews obeyed the commands of God, they lived longer, healthier, had more children. Now, there are several examples. I would say any one of these examples would not amount to really proof. It would just be kind of interesting. But if you look at the cumulative case, it seems to be saying something. Because remember, in the first part of the talk, what did we establish? Well, we established that the universe is created and designed. So what's that tell us about God? That God is very powerful and very smart. But which God? All right, I'm going to argue that from science alone, never mind other evidence, I'd say the God of the Bible. You're probably aware that the Bible prescribes certain meats you can eat and certain meats you cannot eat. For example, pig, no, beef, yes. It just so happens that pork carries at least 22 known diseases, including trichinosis, highly fatal disease. And yet beef can be eaten even raw, and it's relatively safe. A few years ago, I was in Caracas in Venezuela, and I was ordering off the menu. I can read Spanish, but I didn't know what this stuff was. So I said, bring that to me. And they brought a nice plate of raw beef. Well, I thought about Leviticus 11, went for it. Now, it just so happens, coincidence or not, it just so happens that every meat on the okay to eat list is relatively safe, and the meats on the don't eat list are relatively dangerous. For example, shellfish, clams, oysters, lobsters, no. Fish with scales, yes. And shellfish of all varieties could be really, really dangerous. But fish, even raw, we call it sushi, right? Relatively safe. Again, I would say, if this was the only fact we had to present, I would say the skeptic would have maybe reason to think, well, okay, that, all right. But the fact is, all the other peoples ate all of these foods. All of them got many diseases. The Jews did not. I'd say that's telling me something. All right, here we go. Here's another one. This is in Numbers 19. It's the law with respect to touching dead bodies. Whoever touches the dead body of anyone will be unclean for 7 days. Purify him with the water on the third and the seventh day. Take some hyssop, dip it in the water, sprinkle the tent and the furnishings and the people who were there. Very cruel law. Because whoever touches the dead body, for example, in order to prepare it for a funeral, cannot even attend the funeral. What's that all about? Okay? Well, again, with all of these laws, there's going to be a spiritual meaning to it, and there's going to be a medical advantage to it. But in neither case did the Jews know. They didn't know. God didn't say, well, the bacteria, what's he going to say? There's these little microscopic things. Well, what's a microscope? What's this thing? All right. This is Ignaz Semmelweis, a doctor in Vienna. He's working in a woman's hospital. The death rate in that hospital was 18%. That's not good. The reason women did not have their children in the hospital wasn't because they couldn't afford to go to the hospital. It's because they couldn't afford to not go to the hospital. All right? Anyway, I was talking about Semmelweis and his work with what we now call germ theory in Budapest, and I mentioned that he was from Serbia. And they said, no, he's actually from Budapest. I said, no, I'm pretty sure he's from Serbia. They said, no, he's from Budapest. I said, okay. And then they took me to his house later that afternoon. So I now believe he's from Budapest. All right, great. Anyway, here's the deal. In this hospital, the doctors would go in the morning and examine the bodies of the women who died the night before. They call it puerperal fever. And then they would proceed immediately up to the wards to treat the patients. So Semmelweis said, whenever you touch a dead body, you're unclean. Clean your hands very thoroughly with soap and water. As a result, the death rate went down from 18% to 4%, but not to zero. All right? But the Bible not only says when you touch a dead body, you're unclean, it also said when a woman has a baby, or even is having her period, she's unclean. Now, why would God say that? Well, everybody knows that God hates women and he's out to get them and whatever. And that's not why. Because when a woman has her period, and especially when she gives birth, very susceptible to infection. So Semmelweis says, even when you touch a live patient, clean your hands thoroughly with soap and water. The death rate went down to 0.5%, and puerperal fever was eliminated. Okay? By the way, they should have had a parade and a marching band. Instead, they fired him. The death rate went back up, and he died of an infection. All right, now, it just so happens the prescription was this. Take water, ashes from the red heifer sacrifice, and hyssop. Hyssop is an herb, a very, very oily herb, a little bit like thyme. It turns out the oil in the hyssop combines with the ash in the water to make soap. All right, they knew how to make soap back then. That alone is not so amazing. What's amazing is one of the compounds in thymol. 4% of the oil of the hyssop is thymol. And I teach organic chemistry. In organic chemistry, we call these compounds phenols. And it just so happens that thymol, you know that smell, that kind of medicine-y smell in the hospital? You know what it is? Yeah. It's thymol. And the reason is thymol is not poisonous to human beings, but it's a strong antibacterial. So God's prescription, if you touch a dead body, was to clean yourself and everything you touched on the first and the seventh day with a powerful antibacterial soap. Wow. All right. That kind of explains it. All right, here's another one. How about the laws for infectious skin disease? For example, leprosy. Leprosy was the most feared disease in the ancient world. Not because it killed the most people, not even close. Yellow fever killed more. Malaria killed more. But it was the way that it killed that was so horrifying. And they had no answer. By the way, it's caused by bacteria, and now if you take the right antibiotic, it cures it. Right? But they had no answer. Now, the Bible said complete and utter separation. Quarantine. Right? Well, guess what? It works. In the 1500s, there were some monks living in Scandinavia. And by the way, leprosy was very common in Europe at that time. We think of it as being leprosy-free. It's because of following what the Bible says. So they decided to try. Let's try quarantine. It's right there in Leviticus. Within three generations, leprosy had disappeared across Europe. All right? So again, God did not say why to quarantine. He just said to do it. So let's say you're reading the Bible, and you read something, and you don't know why. Let me give you a suggestion. Do it anyway. It might save your life. Just might. All right. Life of every creature. Another one. Leviticus 17:14. The life of every creature is in its blood. That is why I've said to the Israelites, you must not eat in the blood of any creature, because the life of every creature is in its blood. Anyone who eats it must be cut off. Do you know what the most common medical treatment in the West was in the 18th and the 19th century? It was bloodletting or using leeches. Same general idea. Because the accepted idea was when somebody has an infectious disease, the disease is in the blood. Does that make sense? Yes, it does. It explains how it spreads around. The Bible said the life is in the blood. Medical science said the disease is in the blood. Here are some bloodletting instruments. Well, if you have an infectious disease, we have a thing called an immune system, right? And where do you find the immune system? In the blood. All right. And by the way, like I said, there are spiritual meanings as well as health benefits, because we know spiritually the life is in the blood, don't we? All right. You know, I was in Philippines a few years ago, and I was giving a talk for the Bible talk leaders, like 500 of them there, and one of them asked a question, is it okay to eat blood? And I said, well, I had some for lunch, so I hope so. I had blood stew. All right, anyway, Jesus declared all foods clean, correct? By the way, I'd say being aware of some of these laws is helpful, like, for example, with pork, cook it all the way through, okay? Got it. All right, the last one, there are many more examples, just one. This is, by the way, not even in the law of Moses. This is before the law of Moses, all the way back to Abraham. He said, for the generations to come, every male among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised. Two questions. Why circumcision? And why on the eighth day? Okay? Let's talk about why circumcision. Remember, almost everybody back then died of some sort of infectious disease, usually bacteria or fungus. And where do bacteria and fungus grow? Wherever it's dark, warm, and wet. All right? So where's the darkest, warmest, wettest place on a guy? All right. You got that one figured out. Good. We're going to move on quickly. Did you know that it's been shown through multiple studies that AIDS is spread 60% less if the man has been circumcised from man to woman? All right, there's a reason for that. All right, how many lives were saved by male circumcision? And by the way, usually, normally, it was women's lives being saved by this practice. By the way, I've got a better way to avoid getting AIDS than being circumcised. How about following another of the Bible's commands? Yeah. Which is to have sex with only one person. 100% cure. 100% cure. All right? But why the eighth day? That's strange. The first day, all right, as everybody's there, possibly, or, you know, the third day, because of the number three, the Trinity, maybe. Wait, Old Testament, never mind. Or maybe the number 12, because, you know, the 12 tribes. Why the eighth day? I mean, what was the significance of eight amongst the Jews? Again, I don't know, but I think I know, but I might be wrong. Let's talk about the fact that babies would bleed out. It turns out vitamin K does not pass through the placenta. And vitamin K is essential for blood clotting. It's not actually the vitamin K that forms the clot. It's actually prothrombin, which is the protein which is created through the working of vitamin K. And by the way, the one-day-old baby has some prothrombin, but not enough to clot. And then because there's no vitamin K, the level actually goes down for a couple of days. But then the baby eats from the mommy. And by the way, where vitamin K comes from is from bacteria, of which you have none until you're born. So baby eats from mommy, gets bacteria, and the prothrombin level goes up to an unnaturally high level, and then it drops down to the normal level. I'm going to show you a graph. The graph will be prothrombin in the child's blood versus days after birth. There's your graph. Okay. All right. So why circumcision? By the way, guys, you do take a shower, right? So circumcision has significantly less medical value than it had back then. So I'm not trying to lay a guilt trip on you whether you do or you don't circumcise. You know, you could or you couldn't. It's not a Christian thing, you know. But I think we now have an idea of why circumcision. We also have an idea of why circumcision on the eighth day. Because here's the fact. From the day the male child is born to the day they die, the best day to do a circumcision in terms of safety is the eighth day. Or, you know, the ninth day or the seventh day, pretty much equally good. All right, so anyway, I would say, I believe the Bible is inspired by God. I believe the entire thing is inspired by God. Let's say this represents the evidence that the Bible is inspired by God. Of that, the evidence from science is like this much. It's a tiny, tiny fraction. Yeah, it's pretty good. So I believe not only that the universe is created and that there's a God, a creator God, but I believe that the specific one we're talking about is the God of the Bible. All right, now what we're going to do is maybe take a few questions, and then we'll do a break, and then I'll do a second lesson, and the lesson is going to be on the age of the earth and on evolution. Okay, got it? All right, so Dan, should we take some questions, you think, or should we proceed to the break?
Are there some questions anyone would like to ask?
Yeah, we'll take a couple of questions. We'll try to kind of keep it a little bit focused. Yes? All right, you could think of it that way. In other words, for the Greeks, if the male child had been circumcised, it was evidence that there was a Jewish religion going on. In fact, during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes in the 2nd century B.C., the Greeks outlawed circumcision. All right, branding is like an injury done. I mean, yeah. You could call it that. Are you asking why God had them do it or something like that?
No, it was just a question.
All right. Put it this way. When a male child is circumcised, it creates a permanent, sign of it. So, I mean, what is a brand? Almost by definition, a brand is a physical sign of ownership, if you will. All right. So you could call it that. I don't like it, that word. But I guess, in a sense, that is sort of what it is. Basically, it said, this is my child. Here's an interesting fact. Did you know that they didn't do any circumcision while they were wandering in the wilderness? For 40 years, no circumcisions of the male children. And then when they crossed the Jordan, then they did the circumcisions because of the type anti-type relationship between baptism and circumcision, because the first generation was baptized into Moses in the Red Sea, and the second generation was baptized into Joshua in the River Jordan, and then they got circumcised. I saw a question back here somewhere. Yeah. What do you mean the Marian thing?
Marian, like Moses' wife, right?
All right, so why was God upset about that?
I mean, what happened there?
Well, the thing is, he married a non-Jew. He married a Gentile. So therefore, the children would be unclean. All right, now, I'm not going to speak for God as to why he was so upset about that. To me, I'm like, hey, whatever, it's not that big of a deal. But if Moses was going to be the prefigure of the Messiah, of the perfect one, I think that would explain why God made a bigger deal out of it in Moses' case than he would have normally, since Moses was essentially kind of like a Messiah for the Jews, and he was a prefigure of the Messiah, the one who was without sin. That would be my conjecture as to why God made such a big deal, but it's because the child would be unclean. Because remember, whether you're a Jew technically comes through the mother, not through the father. And so because she was a Gentile, I think that's why. Okay, yes?
Oh, hi, Dr. Oaks. My name's Rudy. I've been a disciple since May 5th.
Is there still water on behind the ears there? Yeah. All right.
Amen. So the thymol you talked about,
it's
very fascinating. You kind of describe it as soap, kind of like maybe a sanitizer.
Well, right. If you add ash, water, and oil, that's how you make soap.
Right. So here's my question. So in the context of that scripture, it talks about red heifer specifically.
Yeah.
How you make it. So have you?
All right. Why the red heifer? Good question. All right. The Jews had multiple sacrifices. The red heifer is quite unique. In fact, there's some evidence that the red heifer sacrifice preceded the Mosaic covenant. And the red heifer sacrifice was for purification. And it was the only sacrifice in the whole Old Testament system that was for purification, not just of Jews, but for Gentiles also. So I see some real symbolism here. All right. In fact, the purpose of the red heifer sacrifice was for the cleansing. All right. And so the symbolic meaning of removing sin, the additional symbolic meaning, which is for Jews and for Gentiles, representing that the blood of Jesus would remove the sin of both Jews and Gentiles. So to me, the symbolism is quite deep and especially resonates with the New Testament. There's so much in the red heifer sacrifice. The parallels between the red heifer sacrifice and Jesus are crazy. First of all, it had to be a perfect red heifer, which means any more than three hairs that were not red, and Jesus is the perfect sacrifice. The heifer could have never worn the yoke, representing the fact that it was like a willing sacrifice. Jesus was a willing sacrifice. The red heifer was burned outside the camp as Jesus was killed outside. The parallels are great. So I think that's how that fits. All right, great. We'll take next one better be from a female person, though. I don't want just a bunch of guys. All right, great. So I'll take yours. Oh, no, he's pointing over there. Great. Hello.
Hi. Okay, so the part you were talking about, how if you touch a corpse, you can get the disease. Mm-hmm. So
are you asking why 7 days? Right. So in other words, right after contacting the dead body, they would do this ritual, which apparently was maybe not just a ritual because it did kill bacteria. And then at the end of the period of presumed infection, then they would do it, repeat it again. They didn't just clean their bodies. They cleaned all the items that they touched, which presumably could also have that bacteria. So I can't explain exactly why on the seventh day. I mean, that was a kind of a Jewish thing, you know, a completion, a perfect, the seven being perfect number. I can't tell you exactly why the seventh day, though. All right. Yeah.
So Egyptians, Chinese, Indians, and
yeah.
that you mentioned, the 35-year time period, 3,500 years. Did any of them have similar practices to what the Jews were practicing in the book?
So he's asking, basically what he's kind of getting at, I think, is maybe the Jews were just really good at medicine or something like that. And maybe these other people will. Let me show you a slide that kind of addresses that. Okay, so he's asking, you know, maybe not just the Jews, maybe the Chinese were particularly good. And by the way, the amount of medical wisdom in the Chinese culture is fairly striking. All right, my sister does Chinese medicine, and they actually use monkey dung as one of their medicines even today. I don't know about that, but all right. What are we talking about? Oh, yeah. All right, so I took this from a Jewish writing of sometime, not 1500 B.C., more like around the time of Christ, to demonstrate the idea that it's not that the Jews were good at medicine. So here we go. The gnat, feeble creature, taking in food but never secreting it, is a specific against the poison of the viper. Now, two things. Number one, according to this Jewish statement, flies don't have poop. Now, is that true? That's not true. So that's a science error. And the Bible has no errors like this. The Bible has no errors like the swine's teeth and all that sort of stuff. None ever. All right, and by the way, I don't think it works. And if you had a snake bite, you couldn't go catch flies. Apparently, they keep flies in a jar somewhere, right? Because you got to catch like five. You're all nervous, and oh, if I don't catch the fly, all right. So again, what this shows to me is that it's not some sort of inherent, you know. There's this stereotype. I hesitate to even mention, you know, like Jewish doctors. I mean, it's not like that. I believe that the only way to explain it is because this knowledge came directly from God. I can't say the situation with Egyptian medicine is exactly the same as the situation with Chinese medicine. I would just say, sort of broadly, yes, but specifically, no. I'm not a sufficient expert to answer that question. But to compare it to what the Bible has, there is no comparison. That I will say. Let's take maybe one or two more questions, then we'll take about a 15-minute break. All right, great.
So you mentioned earlier, you know, about the Jewish dietary laws,
yeah.
you know, promoting good health and so forth. But, of course, now we don't necessarily abide by those laws.
Right.
But I think you made mention of, let's say, like with pork, or, you know.
So I think what you're asking is,
pork is fine if you cook it properly, but maybe in those times they didn't have that capability.
I think what you're asking is, would it be a good idea for us to actually observe some of these laws, even though they're not required for religious reasons? And I think probably yes. One of the things he said is cut the fat off the meat. Great idea. All right. How about not getting drunk? Even if there was not a sin involved, a great idea. But, you know, these are things that you can either do or not do. Some of the laws in the Old Testament, given modern medical practices, wouldn't be particularly helpful anymore. Others still are significantly helpful. I would say circumcision is the kind of the ideal example where, it's a little bit debatable. It's a little bit debatable. I know that there's sort of religion-hating groups that want to eliminate circumcision, which is really, that doesn't affect Christians, but that definitely affects Jews. And I believe this is a form of persecution against the Jews, and I find that to be very distasteful. But the Jews defend circumcision for religious reasons, not for health reasons. Now, again, circumcision had great health benefits 1,500 B.C. or even, 500 B.C., I would say the benefits, health benefits, are significant but not massive today. Okay, last question before our break. Okay, You'll have to have a... Yeah, that's a good question. So why not just get rid of them altogether? All right. I think we might have to talk about evolution. Because, you know, why do we have, appendix and things like that? Are there elements of our physical bodies that are evidence of sort of not mistakes, but that evolution has produced some things that are not the absolute ideal solution to the problem? Now, I cannot say for sure. I can't answer your question. I can't. All right, but I would say that probably for some creature at some point, it had a more beneficial thing, you know. But anyway, that's kind of sad that the question we asked right before a break is one where I had to say I don't know. But you know what? If I don't know, I should probably go ahead and say I don't know. So we'll take, what, about a 10, 15-minute break? Great. There's books over there if you're interested. All right. Oh, did I put you asleep?
No, I usually get up so early.
Oh, yeah.
It's not late. Yeah, that's why I follow you everywhere. I like
you.
I thought you was in San Diego. No more?
No, we moved to Bakersfield. I'm leading a church up there.
Oh, good. That's good.
About 7 months ago.
A big difference with the weather.
Oh,
right?
Man, I'm telling you.
How you handle it?
I'm barely handling it. It's not much fun.
It's more than 100.
Yeah, it's about 104 today. It was about 107 yesterday. Ouch. Hey.
Hi. My name is Patrick, and I'm from the Inland Empire region. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to my campus minister about starting, like, a teaching-type ministry.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you had any advice.
Yeah. Number one, go to our teachers' conference next May, first weekend in May. We're going to have a conference for people like you to kind of help you figure that out.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hi.
Is there a website for that?
If you go to my website, there's an announcement about the conference. Do you know my website?
I believe I have it bookmarked.
Yeah. No, the conference doesn't have a website yet. It probably will within about a week or two.
Okay.
You're in the Inland Empire. Who are the kind of teacher-type people over there right now?
We don't really have
any. Oh, that's a problem. But I would say you need to form a little group that meet together, you know, not every week, because maybe every couple months or something like that, and just kind of start talking about teaching things, do some self-training. Maybe one of you could teach a lesson. You could give each other homework. I did that in San Diego over the course of several years, and now we have several well-trained teachers. But it's because we purposely met together and we did that sort of thing. I'd be happy to come down and maybe spend like a Saturday with you guys, just have a little thing sometime. But I would say if you could get two or three to go to this conference, it's in San Antonio on March something like 7th and 8th or 6th and 7th, something like that, I would do that. We haven't had a teachers' conference in many, many years. This is the first one, really, almost in memory. So Inland Empire. Do you have any other guys or girls? By the way, please get some women in that group.
Yeah.
Don't do just men. That'd be a big mistake. Because I think women have the gift of teaching probably the same or more than men, proportionally. Don't do it in secret. Don't hide out. Don't let the leadership know what you're doing. There have been a few cases in the history of our church where the teacher types kind of went off on a sort of a tangent that created problems, so that some leaders are a little bit skeptical. So the way to avoid that is to not create those problems, but partly by communication. Also, if you send me an email, I've written about a 5-page article on how to become a teacher and that kind of stuff. Great. Your name again?
Patrick.
Yeah. Good to meet you.
Nice to meet you also.
Yeah.
Question. The Red Heifer, I thought it was mostly, they did that, it was a ceremonial, because when they go into God's presence, they were supposed to cleanse themselves.
Right.
Yeah, I just wondered, is that
It was ceremonial. Yeah. All of these were ceremonial.
Yes, yes. Okay.
The Day of Atonement was ceremonial.
Yes,
the,
yes, yes.
The guilt offering was ceremonial. Yeah, the, yes. They're all ceremonial.
Yeah,
yeah. So, yeah. True.
I was just wondering because I remember they said they found the red heifer over in Texas. And they were ready to start the sacrifices over in Israel, and they were looking for the red heifer. It's interesting.
Sure, that's been on the...